Ferris B'nai Torah presents The Shmooze, an engaging and motivating Musar and Hashkafa series that deals with real-life issues.
Pozak says, Vayhi achar dvarim eila, after these matters, Velokim nisas Avram, Hashem tested Avram, Vayomer Elov, and Hashem said to Avram, Vayomer Hineni, and Avram answered Hineni. Now this pasuk introduces the Akedah. This pasuk is the beginning of what happens. And last week we discussed in depth the Akedah and what actually transpired, but Rashi picks up on a very obvious issue on this pasuk. And that is the pasuk begins with the words Vayhi achar hadvarim ha'ela, after these matters, referring seemingly to what the Chumash just said a moment ago. But the only problem is, if you look before the beginning of Parshas Vayera, if you look what happened immediately before, it has nothing whatsoever to do with the Akedah. Just a moment ago, the Psukim described with various things happening with Avram Avinu that happened 12 years before this event and has no shaychus whatsoever to the Akedah. So Rashi says, Vayhi achar hadvarim is not referring to the sequence of events in the Chumash, rather it's referring to an event that occurred. And what's that event? Says Rashi, Achadvarav shel Yishmael, after the words of Yishmael, Shayim espoir Yitzhak, Yishmael was bragging, holding, lording himself over Yitzhak, Shemal ben Gimel, Yud Gimel Shana, Yishmael went over to Yitzhak and said, look at you, you had a bris milah, you were 8 days old, that's nothing. I was 13 years of age, I willingly submitted myself to that painful operation, so I am much more chashuv than you. Amalo Yitzchak. Yitzchak said back to Yishmael, Be'ever echada tamirini, with one organ you're bragging. Ilu amalo Yakarish Baruch Hu, if Hashem said to me, Zavach atzmcha, shecht yourself, slaughter yourself. Lo ha'isim akev, I would not have refused. So once Yitzchak said that expression to Yishmael, then the Akedah can begin. And Siftei Chachamim explains actually what's going on. Says Siftei Chachamim, if it could be, Hashem had a problem. And that problem was, how could Hashem test Avram when there are two parties involved in this action? There are two people involved in Akedah Yitzchak. There's Avram to do the shechting and Yitzchak to be the willing participant. How could Hashem test Avram when Yitzchak might refuse? Achar hadvarim ha'ele, after these words, Hashem could test Avram. And the Siftei Chachamim in the name of Nachlis Yitzchak explains why. Because once Yitzchak uttered these words, once he said the words, if Hashem would ask me, I'd willingly slaughter myself, I'd give up my whole life, then it was no longer an nisayon, there was no longer a test, because Yitzchak said it, it was a given, it was pashut, they would fulfill his words. Now Hashem could test Avram. Now that Yitzchak is taken care of, Yitzchak's obviously going to do it, he's not going to renege because he gave his word. Now Hashem says, now I could test Avram. Vayachar dvar me'ela, after these matters, now the Akedah begins. And that's how the Siftei Chachamim explains Rashi. And I think the rather obvious question that begs to be asked is that this does not seem to answer the question. Granted, Yitzchak, in a moment of passion, in a moment of excitement, said the words, if Hashem would ask me, I'd literally give my whole life. But now he's being tested in whether he's going to keep his word. In a flash, Avram takes Yitzchak up, the altar is built, the Mizbeach is already built. Yitzchak, in just a moment, understands that there's no Sela Olah, there's no sheep, there's no animal that's going to be the carbon, it's me. In an instant, in a flash, he knows his life is over. That sounds like a major nisayon. A number of years earlier, in a moment of passion, you said you would give your life, but are you going to keep your word? Right now, your life is on the line. Are you going to abide by your word or not? That sounds like a major nisayon, and it doesn't sound like it answers the question, because right now, the same way Avram Avinu is being tested, it would seem like Yitzchak Avinu is also being tested whether he'll keep his word or not. And it's that question that I'd like to deal with this evening, to see if we can understand what the Siftei Chachamim means that once Yitzchak said the words, there was no nisayon anymore. So let me begin with an observation about the state of truth in the world today. And quite a number of years ago, when John F. Kennedy was elected to office, he made a very telling expression. He said, the thing that surprised me most when taking office was that things were as bad as I had been saying they were. Meaning, for many, many years he had been on the campaign, or certainly many months he had been on the campaign trail, talking about how bad the government is, how bad things are. And his biggest shock was that when he took office, he actually discovered that things were as bad as he was saying they were. Now, gentlemen, what that means in plain language is that up until that point, he was full of it. He was just making this stuff up. He was inventing things that he did not know to be true. In fact, he really thought they weren't true. But that's part of politics. That's part of the game. When Henry Kissinger was appointed Secretary of State, and he first met Mrs. Nixon at a dinner, and he begins talking about how great the president is, and President Nixon is such a man and such a man. At a certain point, Mrs. Nixon looks over at Henry Kissinger and says, "What? You haven't seen through him yet?" His own wife recognized him to be a false buffoon, a fraud. Those are words that he says, that's his persona, that's what he tells people, but you haven't seen through him yet? That's not really the man. The words and the man are distinct, are separate, have no shaychus one to the other. In 1988, Parent magazine did a study. They did a poll, and they asked the following question. Do you believe that politicians are honest? 10% of the people responded yes. That means 90% of the people polled, regular U.S. citizens, assumed that politicians are not honest. What they say is not what they intend to do. And just because they said it doesn't mean that later on, if it's no longer convenient, that they're going to do it. And I guess this is kind of a given. We kind of grown to accept it that politicians lie. It's part of the game. It's just the way it is. But there's another interesting observation that surrounds us all the time, and that is advertising. We are constantly being bombarded by ads. The average person will see a minimum of 400 advertisements a day between billboards, between magazine ads, between every possible situation. You're going to be hit with many, many messages. Now, much of what you see has very little connection to the truth. And I want to share with you just a few observations only to illustrate the point. If you study much of Procter & Gamble's products, you'll see the words new and improved. Now, it's a very simple thing. If something is new, by definition, it means it hasn't been on the market before because it's new. If something is improved, then by definition, it means it's been here before, and now this is the second version, this is improved. New and improved are mutually exclusive. If it's new, it means it's new, it can't be improved because it wasn't here before. If it's improved, so it's been here before, so it can't be new. How could you have something that's new and improved? The answer is you can't. But don't worry about it, because it's one of the most used lines in all of marketing. New and improved is used so often that it really, to a large extent, has lost any meaning other than just it's a catchphrase and sort of catches your eyes. And I want to share with you just a few examples, and I don't really have to share, you probably know them better than I, but let me just give you a few just to look at this. Do you ever hear the expression, this is an exclusive offer? This is an exclusive offer. The only problem is that 30 million people are having and hearing and being bombarded with this exclusive offer. Okay? Now, what about a line, and this is taken right off an ad, everybody has one of these except you. Now, gentlemen, if everybody had one of these, they wouldn't have to be marketing it. They wouldn't have to be putting ads on the radio or TV or whatever, because everybody has it already. Clearly, not everybody has it. All right? Now, you're not yet appreciating where I'm going with this. What about the following? Now, this is a Maisa Shahai. A guy gets up on TV and says the following. I didn't get to see this. I had to read about it. And he says as follows. I am not a doctor, but I play one on television. And therefore, you should listen to me when he endorses a patent medicine. Wait a minute, again. I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV. And therefore, and he goes on to do the whole spiel about why you should use this particular medicine because it's very good for you. Now, wait a minute. Somebody paying attention. Let's not even deal with the insult of the intelligence. But there's an implied sheker there. The implied sheker that's in those words are, because I play Marcus Welby or I play a physician on TV, therefore my words has more credibility. You should listen to my words because I am telling you this medicine is good for you. All right, now if you don't feel this yet, I think there should be nothing more obvious than cigarette ads. Now let's understand, folks. Cigarettes will shorten your lifespan by 10 years. They'll dramatically increase the odds of you getting emphysema, lung cancer. They also give you very bad breath. So it's a hard product to sell, to make glamorous, to make glorious, and really push. Okay, how do you put a positive image on death and disease? So Madison Avenue does it. Let's start with a couple of taglines. Camel Filters. Camel Filters has the following tagline: it's a whole new world. What that implies is, and you'll see the cigarette in that commercial, when you smoke it, it's a whole new world. Now, folks, I want to let you in on a secret. Your world will not dramatically change because you smoke Camel or Marlboro or Kent. It really won't dramatically change your world. But that's what they're telling you, whether directly or implied. What about Vantage Cigarettes? Vantage Cigarettes is a very interesting tagline. The taste of success. Now, I always wanted to taste success. Success, that's a good thing. Succeed, success, that's a good thing. Would you like to taste success? Smoke Vantage Cigarettes and you will taste success. Now, does anybody believe that? Is anybody stupid enough to actually say that? Well, Rabosai, they're spending millions, if not billions of dollars. Weiss doch eis, it works on some level. One more, because this is the ultimate of all ironies. If you were selling a death machine, or you were selling an implement of death, like a cigarette, would you use the following tagline, which Newport uses? Alive with pleasure. Oh, get it. Alive with pleasure. First of all, I don't know. Listen, I don't smoke, but I can't think of smoke. What? Pleasure. Wow, a cigarette. Whoa. But using the expression alive with pleasure for a cancer stick is a little questionable. But that's advertising. It's the game. We know it. We don't really believe it. We don't really react to it because we don't anticipate or expect them to be really telling the truth, so it doesn't shock us and doesn't move us. I want to share with you something that did shock someone. Watch the following. When Yaakov Avinu comes to the well, he's now about to meet Rachel, and he sees that there are a few shepherds gathered there, and he has a conversation with them. And here's how the conversation opens up. Do you know Lavan? And they say, yes, we do know Lavan. So Yaakov Avinu then asked, what hashalom lo? What's his peace? What's doing in his house? And they say, everything's doing well. And then Yaakov says something very out of character. He says to them, well, guys, you should go back to work. Oda Yom Gadol, there's still a lot of time left in the day. It's not the time to gather the son. Go feed them, go drink, give them to drink, and then go bring them out to the field. And Rashi's bothered by why is Yaakov telling them to go back to work. So Rashi explains, because he saw them just sort of lounging around, he assumed that their plan was to end the day early. They would be stealing from their bosses. And therefore he said to him that you should finish your day's work. And Elamai, maybe it's your own sheep, you're not working with somebody else, so then it's not lazy, you should make sure to go back out and go to the field. Now, you may be wondering that what Yaakov Avinu is doing here is potentially dangerous and at least rude. He never met these men before. There are a number of shepherds who are sitting there, and he starts giving them mussar as if to say, go back to work. What are you guys doing hanging around? What are you doing lazing around? Go back to work. Number one, it's dangerous. You don't go give mussar to people that you don't know. And number two, it's plain rude. It is rude for me to tell you what to do about your business. Don't be lazy. Go back to work. So why is Yaakov Avinu doing this? And I believe that when we hear the answer, I think we'll have a little bit of an inkling of what's going on here. In the 1980s, there was a gentleman named Manute Bol. Manute Bol was 7'7". He was a tribesman in Sudan, and somebody discovered him because he wasn't just 7'7", but he had arms that seemed to go on forever. And they brought him in first to play college ball and eventually to play in the NBA. Now, interestingly enough, I don't know how talented he was. The first time he tried to dunk, he chipped his front two teeth. But the interesting thing about the fella is that he could dunk the ball with both feet flat on the floor, which gives you a certain advantage if you're playing ball. The coaches described that nobody could get a shot past him because his arms just seemed to keep going out all over the place. Now, the reason why I mentioned Manute Bol is because there was an interview when he first made it into college ball. And Sports Illustrated went down to discuss, and they spent the day, you know, interviewing him and going through his day, etc. They were looking for an angle. And at some point, the TV was on, and the interviewer described that Manute Bol got angry. he got angry and he said to the interviewer, look at that, she's lying. She doesn't wear that clothing. Why don't you stop it? Why do you put up with this? She's lying. Don't you understand that she's lying? And he got very offended and very angry by the fact that an actress was presenting clothing or some type of trinket as if implying that she wore it, she uses it, and it's good. And he was furious that why do you allow these people to lie? Why do you just sit back when they do it? And you know what the problem was? He took them at face value. He took the people on TV as if they were people of their word who said things and as if they intended to mean it, and he took it literally. But we never have that reaction because we know that they lie. And we're so accustomed to it that it doesn't even hit a person. Gentlemen, I want you to understand, a tzaddik has a very, very difficult problem hearing a lie. We become desensitized, but a tzaddik has a very difficult problem and a lot of trouble hearing a lie. I remember Reb Yaakov once, it was very interesting, Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, throughout his days, would not eat gebrochs. He wouldn't eat on Pesach when he eat gebrochs, and he one time explained that even though his family, the minhag was, but at a certain point in his life, he stopped eating gebrochs. And it wasn't because of the issue of not eating gebrochs on Pesach. It was quite simple. When he was a bachur in yeshiva, a certain family invited him over to eat Pesach meals by their house, and he felt uncomfortable. He really didn't trust their kashrus. But he didn't want to tell them, you know, that I don't trust your kashrus, so he sort of found a way out of it. He said the word, well, I don't eat gebrochs. And he knew that they did, so they weren't insulted. They knew that he wouldn't eat by them because he doesn't eat gebrochs, and therefore he got out of it without insulting the people. Now that's 100% mutter. Being meshaneh, lying b'nei ha'shalom is 100% mutter, and he did the right thing. From that point on, he stopped eating gebrochs. Why? I said the word, I have to keep it. Once I said, I don't eat gebrochs, that's it, I'm not doing it anymore. And for the rest of his life, he wouldn't do it. I'll give you one more interesting example. Rav Eisen was a Rav in Yerushalayim. And he made a bar mitzvah for his son and he invited all the gedolei hador, all the gedolim in Yerushalayim came to this bar mitzvah. And at a certain point he realized, oyvei, I didn't invite Rav Issa Zalman Melser. I forgot. And he's about to send a messenger quick to go to Rav Issa Zalman's house to bring him because he felt it was an insult. When who walked in the door but Rav Issa Zalman Melser? And Rav Eisen walks over, Shalom Aleichem, I'm so glad the Rosh Yeshiva came. Rav Issa Zalman said, of course I came. Don't you remember? I gave you my word. Rav Eisen said, what do you mean? Rav Issa Zalman said, I guess you don't remember. When your son was born, you invited me to the Shalom Zachar. I apologize, I wasn't feeling well. I said I can't come, but in Mitzvah Hashem, I'll come to the Bar Mitzvah. I'm here. 13 years later, I said I would be there. I would be there. Gentlemen, would you like to know why Yaakov Avinu reacted to these shepherds lying around? Because he saw thievery. He saw gezel. He saw lying. He saw cheating. And it bothered him inside. It bothered him. He couldn't sit by and watch. He had to react, albeit he might have well transgressed a certain code of propriety. You don't go over to strangers and start giving them mussar. But it bothered him so. There was such an abhorrent sense that he felt when he saw it. You're stealing. You're stealing money. He couldn't keep himself quiet because it bothered him. It was eklektic to him. And as a result, he said these words to him. And gentlemen, I believe that that's pshat in Yitzhak. You see, when Yitzhak Avinu said the words, if Hashem would ask me to give up my life, I would do it. His word was given. And once a tzaddik gives his word, there's no choice, there are no questions, there are no dilemmas. I said I would do it, I will do it. Meaning to a tzaddik, his word is his word. Ad kedei kach, that the Siftei Chachamim says there was no nisayon. What do you mean? But you said it in a moment of passion. You were excited because Yishmo was bragging. You just said the words, yeah. But I gave my word. Once I give my word, there's no nisayon, there's no test. Now Hashem says to Avram, now it's time I can test you because it's a given. There's no question that Yitzhak will do because he said he would do it. And once a man of his word gives his word, he doesn't go back on it, he keeps it. And at that point, there was no nisayon left for Yitzhak Avinu because he said it. And I think it's an interesting illustration of what it means to keep one's words, what it means to be an ish emes. And it's something that in our world, our society, we typically don't really see. But I think there's another application to emes that goes well beyond the way we typically understand it. And I'm going to borrow some material from the evolution shmooz number 22, with your permission. We discussed then that there's an interesting phenomenon in our world. The world we live in is occupied by many, many, many creatures. As a matter of fact, in the insect world alone, there are 1.5 million species of insects. And they reproduce at a very quick rate, and they're very, very hardy. Scientists explain to us that by all rights, the insects should keep on multiplying, should become so populous that they should overrun planet Earth. There should be thick swarms wherever you go, mounds and mounds of insects upon insects upon insects, until life on this planet should be unbearable, potentially inhabitable. However, that's not the way it is. The primary reason why the insects are not overtaking the Earth is because they're predators. There are those that make their living by eating insects. So that the insects reproduce, there are many of them, the predators eat the extra, keeping a perfect balance so that there are constant influx, there are constant birth, there are constant reproducing of the insects. Many, many are eaten, there's a constant balance, and the earth remains as it is. Now, one of the main predators to insects are a very common little brown bat. Weighs about, well, doesn't weigh much, it's a little, kind of looks like a mouse with wings. Interesting enough, the average brown bat will eat on a given night approximately half a pound of insects. Half a pound of insects, and it'll catch them in mid-flight. Mosquitoes, gnats, flies, in mid-flight, picks them off and eats throughout its night about a half a pound of them. You might wonder, how is it that the bat manages to catch them in mid-flight at night when it's pitch black? Especially considering that most bats are blind, as in the expression, blind as a bat. Interestingly enough, the bat doesn't navigate by its sense of sight. It relies on its sense of hearing, something called echolocation. Echolocation means it emits a sound and listens to the reverberation, listens to the bouncing back of the sound. So for instance, if a bat is a distance from the wall, it emits a sound, and based on the time that it takes for the sound to come back, the bat can tell whether it's close or far. Now that's not so impressive if you're maybe 100 feet from a wall and you want to tell whether there's a wall 100 feet or a wall 50 feet. The problem is that the bat has to navigate very, very tiny, very, very densely populated areas. And it has to tell whether something is a half an inch or an inch or an inch and a half. You know what the difference in time travel, the difference between a sound traveling between half an inch and an inch is? It's approximately somewhere in the vicinity of 0.00007th of a second or 0.00008th of a second. Would you like to try to figure out yourself the difference in that time? Don't bother, because we can't hear it, we can't relate to it. But in the bat brain, which is probably not too big because the whole thing ain't too big, within the bat brain is enough computer programming to decipher whether the timing on it is very, very quick, very, very slow, and it's able to decipher the echoes that come back. So the bat emits a sound, and it's able to tell you how far the object is, how dense the object is, because density will determine how much sound comes back. It's able to measure, and it creates a sound image. In its brain, there's a sound image, and it sees the world through a world of sound. By sending out sound and hearing back, and being able to measure and gauge and doing the advanced mathematics, it determines which things are close, which are branches, which are flies, which things are farther away, and it's able to read the world in a purely audible manner, hence it navigates its way around. Now, gentlemen, that is very, very sophisticated, very, very difficult to do. I know that because sonar, which is the way that submarines discover, or boats, ships discover whether there are other submarines underneath them, use very, very advanced programming to make those calculations and determinations. All that done within the bat brain. But here's the strange part about it all. If you remember the way movies used to start, a movie is basically a series of still pictures. The animators, if you remember the old comics, the way an animator would do, let's say, Mickey Mouse, so they'd draw one picture of Mickey with his hand here, next frame here, next frame here, next frame here, but by moving it quickly in front of your eye, you just see the smooth motion. The average frames of an animation was 32 frames per second. 32 images per second. You don't see the staccato movements, you just see the smooth movement. Fine. The problem is that the bat has got to see things in live time, just like you and I. When I see your finger move across, I don't notice that it's staccato. If I was so movie of it, my mind would fill in the gaps. But the bat has got to navigate in mid-flight, and it's got to be sending out enough messages and getting them back so that it's seeing approximately at least 32 per second. But gentlemen, the bat does not emit 32 sounds per second. That's when it's resting. When it's resting, it'll emit about 10 sounds per second. When it's in mid-flight trying to catch a fly who's trying to go the other way and not become dinner, it emits sounds at 200 beats per second. 200 times a second it's emitting a sound and interpreting it back in its brain, emitting, interpreting, so that it has an image of that fly in its brain. The fly moves in live time. It sees the movement back and forth, and in its bat brain, it's interpreting and reading all this stuff. Now, gentlemen, this part, just hold cup with this. It's a little complicated, but it's a very, very important point. In World War I, the dog fights were very fierce. Someone came along with a chop to understand that there's a problem having a dog fight in midair. They're propeller planes. Most of the pilot's vision is blocked by propellers. There's a propeller either right over here or if they're on the side of the wings, but everything that's directly in front of them is covered by propeller. How do you fight, how do you shoot at another plane when the propeller's right there? So they worked this out, and they figured out the timing to be such that they mounted machine guns that shot right through the propeller. The timing was such that as the blade moved here, the bullet went through. The next blade came up, the next bullet came through. Blade, bullet, blade, bullet. The timing was exquisite. Exquisite. Because that was the timing needed to shoot through a propeller. Okay. Now, keeping that in mind, here's an interesting observation. If the bat is going to emit sounds that are going to bounce back, the sound has to be very, very loud. Because it has to send it out against something and hear back the return. It has to speak very loudly and have very sensitive ears to be able to hear. Why is it that the bat doesn't make itself deaf? It's screaming to hear the return, the echo off the wall, but the problem is its ears are right there. So why doesn't the bat make itself deaf with its loud screams and sensitive ears? Gentlemen, would you like to know why? It's actually quite simple. Because inside the ear of the bat, there's the anvil, the bone that kind of vibrates and sends the message to the eardrum. That bone that vibrates with sound has a muscle. As the bat screams, that muscle stops the bone from moving. As soon as the screech stops, the muscle relaxes, so the bone moves again. When it screams again, the muscle stops it. When it stops screaming, the bone moves again. 200 times a second, exactly coordinated to the bat screams, the muscle stop, go, exactly coordinated so that the bat can scream, not deafen itself, but then immediately release it so it could hear the echoes. 200 times a second, live time. But that's not the amazing part yet. Here is the amazing part. Bats do not live alone. Batman might, but bats do not. Bats live in caves that are aggregated by hundreds, if not thousands, of other bats. How is it that if you're in a cave and there are thousands of bats screaming and there are echoes and yelling and screeching 200 beats a second, how does the bat hear its own echo? How does it not get confused with some other bats and 200 other bats and 1,000 other bats? There are all these echoes back and forth. How does it not just get lost in mid-flight? The answer is inside the bat brain is a filtering mechanism. That it's able to hear other bats' cries, but it ignores them and only focuses in on its own frequency. Hence, it hears with perfect clarity its echo and filters out every other bat's echo. Gentlemen, if you want to be a mamin, study this, think about it, and say, wow, that's astounding. But would you like to know what's even more astounding? I got this entire little repertoire over here from a book written by an evolutionist whose name is Richard Dawkins. And Richard Dawkins goes at length explaining all of these facts. When I read this, I say, Marabu Masecha Hashem, this makes me a much, much bigger Baal Emuna. And you know what Richard Dawkins does with this? He says, one simple teretz. Isn't it amazing how things evolved? And he goes through each step, the bat brain, the echoes, the sound, the speeding up, the reading, the dimensions of math. He goes through it in detail. He's an Oxford zoologist. He's a very bright fellow. He goes through it all in detail, and his answer to every step of the way is one thing. Oh, isn't it amazing how things evolved? Isn't it amazing how and each step, that's his teretz. Now, gentlemen, you don't have to be a tremendous pikeach to understand that it's nonsense. And would you like to know what he's guilty of? He's guilty of only one sin, and that's called he's a liar. You're a shakran. You're telling a bald-faced lie. You're inventing things that are so ludicrous and so ridiculous. There is no way that the bat brain evolved into that highly sophisticated computer technology. There's no way that that muscle developed at 200 beats a second. There's no way that the bat was able to read these things. And saying it just evolved, lucky random mutation, doesn't answer the question. What does answer the question is that he's a liar. And he's involved, as all the evolutionists are, in one simple activity. It's not a lack of faith, not a lack of emunah, not a lack of betochen, it's simple lying. Listen to the words of the Orach HaTzaddikim. Orach HaTzaddikim says, Kesheyesh emes bibnei adam, when there's truth amongst people, as modim sha'asa shamayim v'aretz v'yam v'skol shabam, then people admit that Hashem created shamayim v'aretz v'skol shabam. Would you like to be a Baal Emunah? What you need is one quality. It's called truthfulness. Look at this world. Look at the sophistication. Look at the amazing complexity. Look at the 1.5 million species of insects and say to yourself, gee golly, not only do they all exist, but they're all kept in balance. And what you see, if you have emes, you see a creator. But if you don't have emes, so you see nothing. You lie conveniently, you destroy truth, hence nothing moves you. Would you like a definition of emes? Says Rabbi Saul, the definition of emes is a very simple thing. Words that come out of my mouth match what's in my heart. I don't utter words that in my heart I know not to be true. That's emes. And if you've ever watched a salesman, or if you're in sales yourself, you'll know it's not so pushit. It's not so pushit to be an ish emes, to speak words, to only speak words that in my heart I know to be true. And you may find it a bit of a challenge. In my day, we had a guy in yeshiva who was selling his car. And you want to see what an ish emes is? Long. I remember when I was in yeshiva, there was a guy who was selling his car. But this guy was a very solid Baal Midos. And the guy who was buying his car came over afterwards and said, the guy's crazy. Everything he told me about the car, this is wrong with it, that's wrong with it. He didn't tell me anything good about the car. He just told me all the chesronos with the car. Now, gentlemen, I'm not advocating selling your car that way, nor selling your wares that way. But the Mesillas Sharim has a very interesting description to how to sell. He says, if you have a product, and the product is good, and you demonstrate the good parts of the product, and you're not covering up the bad, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But if you're demonstrating the good because you're covering up the bad, or you're skipping over the bad, or you're exaggerating the good, that is sheker. That's sheker, it's kozev, it's lying, and ultimately it's ono, and ultimately it's geneva. And I think it's an important thing to hear. It's an important thing to hear that there's a concept called emes, and that a concept called emes goes very far, and that concept called emes is something that changes within you the way you look at things and the way you view things. Not long ago, I had a conversation with a frum gentleman. This was a gentleman who had entered into a business contract with I entered into a business contract with him, and he not only broke the contract, he did exactly the opposite of what the contract said. Now, I had two choices. Take him to court, take him to Beis Din, neither of which I wanted to, so I decided not to, but I sat down with the master and I said, I have only one question. That you did what you did, all right, whatever, I'm not asking, but I have a question to ask you. That question is, you signed a contract that you said you're giving your word that you're not going to do this, and you went ahead and did it. How could you do that? And he said, very simply, I understood when I signed it that it was not enforceable in court. I knew you'd have a tough time beating me in court on it, so with that intention I signed it, so therefore, whatever. What? What did you say? What you just said was, I'm a liar, it wasn't enforceable in court, so it didn't bother me the fact that I gave my word. Gentlemen, there was a time when a man's word was his word. When a man said his word and his honor was at stake, he stood by his word for no other reason than he had the self-respect that this is emes, this is my word, and I stay by it. When Yitzhak Avinu said these words, if Hashem would tell me to shecht myself, I would do it, that was it. His word was given, there was no nisayon left anymore. There was nothing left. There wasn't a fight. When Yaakov Avinu saw sheker, it bothered him. It bothered him to the extent that he had to say something that may have not been totally appropriate because he couldn't resist. He couldn't stand by looking at sheker. And unfortunately, because we are exposed to such sheker, whether it be in politics, whether it be in advertising, whether it be just living in the world of words are cheap. What you say is one thing, what you do is another. To a certain extent, I think it affects us, and to a certain extent, I think it shapes who we are. And would you like to know the real damage of sheker? I believe the real damage of sheker is not even keeping your word, not even hurting the other person. The real damage of sheker is damaging yourself. You see, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us an inner compass. Hashem gave us an ability to discern truth, an ability to understand things, and there's a very delicate compass in the human heart. The human heart internally is set for truth. But it's a funny thing that you can do to that. If you lie, if you speak words of lie, if you think lies, what you do is you corrupt it. You corrupt it till it no longer functions. You corrupt it to the extent that you could look. An intelligent, wise man could look at the wisdom of this world, the beauty of this world, the sophistication of this world, and say, well, I guess it evolved. Even though you and I see that as the absurdity for what it is, he doesn't see it that way because his internal clock of emes isn't set. He doesn't hear it. And as a result, he lives that way. Now, my friends, it's a very important thing to hear, to understand. Emes is something that requires training in, sensitivity in. It's something that we're exposed to the opposite keseder and requires a certain training to become an ish emes. To become an ish emes, as Mesillas Yesharim describes, as Rabbi Yisrael describes, my words that I speak match exactly to what's in my heart. If in my heart I feel something, I speak it. Now that doesn't mean I'm callous. That doesn't mean I speak words that are foolish. It doesn't mean if I think you're ugly, I tell you you're ugly. It means if I'm speaking words, there's a consistency between my heart and my mouth. And that means that any words I speak matches what I feel unless there's a very particular reason not to say them. But if I tell you my word that matches my heart, and if I say a word, I keep it. I want to close with a personal story that moved me to a dramatic extent. I only found this out when I was older in life. My mother was brought up by her Aunt B. Now, Aunt B was single, and she died a spinster. She had never married. And as it turned out, the reason why she never married was directly related to my mother. When my mother was 6 years old, her mother died. Before my mother's mother, before my grandmother died, she called her sister, B, to the hospital bed, and she said, take care of Isabel, my mother. At that point, my mother was a skinny 6-year-old kid. She was frail. She was pale. And Aunt B took that as a deathbed promise when she said the words, I will do that. She was going out with someone at the time. They were close to being engaged. She said to this person, if you want to marry me, that's fine, but I have to wait till Isabel is grown. And in fact, that's what she did. She didn't go out. She didn't have any romantic relationships until my mother was a grown woman. At that point, Aunt B was already too old to marry, and she died a spinster. Rabosai, that is a remarkable illustration of what emes means. Emes means I gave my word, it was a promise, and I keep it, despite the fact that it's very inconvenient, despite the fact that it dramatically changes my life. But gentlemen, Aunt B was not a godel. She was not Sarah, Rivka, and Rachel. She was a regular Jewess, a regular person. But there was a sense of my word is my word, I gave my word, and I keep my word. And that's something that the Torah expects from us. That's something we see by Gedolim, but that's something that basic human honor, basic human dignity demands. If I give my word, I keep it because I'm a man of my word. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu grant us the wisdom and the fortitude to be able to keep to this.
You've been listening to The Shmooze, presented by Teferis B'nai Torah. For more information on The Shmooze, please visit us at www.theshmooze.com, where you can download all the Shmoozin free of charge, as well as view source sheets and address questions or comments on this or any other Shmooze. The Shmooze is completely funded by private donations. We need your help to continue our work. All donations are tax-deductible and count as miser. Please help us help others by calling 866-613-TORAH. That's 866-613-TORAH. Or you can make your donation right on the web at www.theshmooze.com.